Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. And now let's get started with today's program. My guest today is Paul Bradley, CEO of Eventric. Paul comes by his tour management software obsession naturally. After starting his own promotion company to bring major jam bands to Des Moines, Paul went back to his hometown of Chicago to work at Tantrum Records, managing and booking tours. When a member of the Irish powerhouse band, the Drovers, couldn't hit the road, Paul leaped into the breach and learned the band's eclectic drum parts on the fly. But Paul knew on the fly was not the way to roll. As a tour manager and a road warrior, he knew things needed to be organized and planned and structured to maximize the impact and the experience. So with decades of hands-on touring and tour management experience, Paul and Ian Kuhn built what became Master Tour. 80,000 users later, Master Tour is the go-to tool for Jay-Z, Katy Perry, AC/DC, Heart, and many more groups. Now, Eventric is an online service provider for the professional live entertainment industry. Their products include Master Tour and promote connectivity, community, and competency to make the events more profitable and effective. And Eventric's customers include artist management, tour and event production companies, event venues, and festivals. Paul, thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to learn about how you decided to create this product that didn't exist, that you knew instinctively was needed, and what that path looked like.
Sure. Well, it was a pretty long process, and I kind of fell into it accidentally. I didn't originally go out looking for a product like this or thinking there was a need. But as you said in that nice intro, after I started a promotion company in Des Moines, that kind of got my interest in the music business going. And after graduating, I moved back to Chicago and started working for an independent record label. They had a few bands on their roster, and I was just doing kind of general internee type things. And that led into doing more assistant management things. Then the primary band, the Drovers, discovered that I could drive the van for extended periods of time. So they brought me on the road as their tour manager. Did that for a few weeks, or maybe it was a few months. I can't really remember the time frame. But during that time, through a series of events, I became their drummer, which was supposed to be just a three-week replacement for their existing drummer. That turned into 7 years of touring as the band's drummer, percussionist, as well as being the tour manager, kind of assistant manager, and just doing a lot of things kind of on the business side of the band.
So when we think of a tour manager not being, you know, musicians and things that go out and like that, kind of explain what the tour manager does. How does the performance and event things work from the band side, from the artist side?
Yeah, sure. No, the kind of whole touring professionals that surround a band are pretty critical. When you're talking about, most of the time when you're talking about touring professionals, it's a tour manager, it's a production manager, a road manager, a tour accountant, a publicist. These people are hired kind of as the executive team, operational team of a band, you know, so they're kind of the CEO, COO, you know, of a tour. Now, smaller bands like I was in, we didn't really hire a crew or tour manager, we just did everything ourselves, you know, so okay. We all wore a lot of hats.
So you're a musical small business.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, okay. it at the level I was in starting off, it was definitely, you know, there was five, sometimes six members of the band, you know, and four of us, you know, would kind of run the business from, you know, doing all of the, you know, day-to-day operational things to, you know, budgeting for a tour, to financing a tour. The other part of the band, you know, would kind of be in charge of creating the music and the recording and managing the studio. You know, so it was a management team, and everyone had different roles.
So you have a lot of these moving parts, because you've got the creative side, you've got the performance side, you've got the logistical side of getting from this venue to this venue, managing the calendar, just making all of those pieces come together.
Yeah, exactly. And it's challenging too, because, you know, again, when you're at a size band like I was in, a lot of the operational things get in the way of the creative elements of being in the band. And I know personally, you know, I focused a lot more time into kind of building the business of the band. And at times not as much being, you know, a musical contributor to the band. So that's a challenge, kind of that balance, but you know, both, you have to do both. And we weren't big enough to hire people to come in. You know, we couldn't hire outside management, you know, or business management or legal, you know, or lawyers to come in, just because we weren't making a lot of money. We needed to, you know, retain every bit of income we could. So we, you know, kind of forces bands at our level to do everything ourselves.
Well, again, that's like a small business. We have limited resources, limited time. We wear lots of hats, and then we have this confusion or this conflict of working in the business and working on the business.
Right. And it's probably very similar to, you know, any creative small businesses, where a big, you know, element of the success of that business is based on the creative, you know, the creative output of the product.
Right.
You know, for a painter or, you know, for anyone, I guess, that's in that field, where, you know, in the perfect world, they have that support team. And that's very key, kind of at the next stage of a band, which the band I was in kind of flirted with. Like, we occasionally peaked up into a level where we could afford, you know, support staff and things that made life more comfortable, so we could focus more on the music. But there was that always underlying stress of, you know, how are we going to pay for the next tour? You know, how are we going to pay for our equipment or for our van or for payroll, or, you know, even just kind of the basic necessities. And, you know, the critical thing that bands experience at that next level is when they become big enough, you know, whether that's through more touring or more successful touring or a bigger fan base. Certainly in the 90s, it was from selling more, you know, CDs that brought in more revenue, or getting record advances. And that was kind of a pretty typical path in the 90s for bands. You know, they would get some set of success, and then record labels would come in, sign them, give them a signing bonus, which the band would then use to, you know, typically record the next album. But a lot of times, if it was a good deal, you know, the label is saying, here's money for you guys to be comfortable, you know, and we'll help you worry about all of the financial aspects. You just create the best music you can, and, you know, take the financial burden off, at least for a while. Now, that was always great at the beginning, you know, but then inevitably, if that, you know, music that was produced from that period, you know, wasn't a success, then you had that burden of owing the label the money, and you're kind of back to square one, except you had, you know, taken these massive advances, basically like a loan. You know, so it, you know, you saw a lot of bands kind of in that era where it was so dependent on a record label being the financier, you know, of their livelihood and of the music. And then when that didn't succeed, you know, a lot of times the labels would just drop them. And, you know, you don't really owe the labels the money if you're dropped. I guess that's better than a bank. But it disrupted the bands a lot, you know, and the morale. You know, you just saw kind of being broken a lot because they kind of got that taste of what the next level is. And a lot of bands, I don't think, were able to kind of bring it back down to a point where they're self-managing themselves, you know, and more on a bootstrap type of budget.
Well, and that kind of leads into where you got thinking about software and solutions, because you're essentially, like, again, like a small business, you're using spreadsheets, you're using these little shoebox type systems to do this on the road, and you knew there was a better way to do this.
Yeah, even when I started working, you know, as an intern, you know, I didn't go to school for, you know, for software coding, for computers or anything, but I kind of knew a little bit enough to start creating databases and templates for contracts, you know, a very basic database structure. So that was kind of part of my role in the band, just kind of bringing some sort of systems to, you know, the small operations, just from tracking tours to guest lists to merchandise, you know, to settlements. for the tours that they were doing. And I continued to do that when I was on the road. And, when you tour, especially at the level we were at, where we were doing, over 200 shows a year, with six people in a van, crisscrossing the country, with a van trailer. There's a lot of downtime, there's a lot of 6-hour drives per day that you're just in the van listening to music or, working on a laptop. Mm-hmm. And so during that time, I just started continually to build and create more, systems, just for the basic track, the operations that we had. We were just figuring out a need that we had, and I was just developing around that. And then another key step kind of towards the formation of this business was when the co-founder of the company, good friend of mine, Ian, was hired as our sound engineer. He had just worked with the Smashing Pumpkins for 5 or 6 years, and we hired him to kind of be our front of house guy. He's the one that kind of managed all the sound, mixed all the sound for live performances. But he had equally created some kind of database for the Smashing Pumpkins. And then he and I just started kind of talking about it. We were both very enthusiastic about, what the system could do. And again, just building on it at any chance we could, not really thinking that there was a business at any point. So then that went on for a year or so. Ian was hired from us to go to the Dave Matthews Band in a similar role. And he introduced the software that, that we were kind of using to the band. And they embraced it, and that's kind of when it really kickstarted to a much bigger product, because Ian continued to develop it around Dave Matthews. I would kind of help during that process, so we were both just feeding into the program as Dave Matthews needed more and more functionality, and I was still applying it to the smaller level of bands that I was in. So at a certain point, it wasn't really until other bands, as we were showcasing the software to other bands that we were associated with through my band and the Matthews band, that the Neil Youngs and the Third Eye Blinds and the Foo Fighters and the Beastie Boys became interested in it. And we just started giving it away at that point to these other bands. We thought it was cool that they'd be interested. Right. They found it interesting to use. So that was kind of the early spark of, hey, might be able to build a business around this.
So you were filling a need that you had, and then realizing it started being kind of viral because the people saw it was working for you, and then you got to road test it literally.
Yeah, I mean, it was very fortunate, looking back, technically this was the formation of a startup company. We had the fortunate opportunity of kind of being in the field and road testing this for, 5-8 years before we even thought of it to be a product. And I think, I think if from day one we went out and said, okay, this is going to be a blockbuster software product for the entertainment industry, and we started with that, kind of with that concept, I don't know if it would have been as successful. It was very organic. We didn't think of it as a business until years and years later.
So it took 5 to 10 years to be an overnight success.
right, exactly.
Just like bands, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities between the two, for sure. From the way you operate as a business, from the way, kind of the peaks that you get, and the financing options, So, yeah, it's and more bands these days, I believe, look at their careers as a business. And for the most part, contribute, a lot towards the musical side of it, the creativity part. But I think if you want to be a successful band, you've got to spend as much, attention and resources into the business side of it, to make it successful.
Let's talk about that. So you started raising money, I think you said, in 2009 for this business. What was that process like? How did you decide how much you needed, and who did you decide to talk to do that?
So that, again, after years and years of putting the product into the market, eventually we started charging people for it, which was a novel concept for a small business, to actually charge something for your product.
Right.
And it's funny that we again, being the master businessmen we were, we didn't even think of charging people until somebody asked us how much it was. And that's where I'm like, oh, you would actually pay for this. That's a good idea. Maybe we'll charge people instead of giving it away. So we, through various pricing models in the 90s, a lot of different revisions in the software, and it was still Ian and I operating the business. We were both still touring, so it was kind of a little bit, hard to maintain the business and the customer base on the side. I had kind of winded down the business, my touring at this point. Ian was still on the road, and the product was starting to break and bend. And again, we weren't, kind of trained developers, so we didn't construct the service or the product correctly from the start. Just every time someone needed a feature, we'd kind of stick it on or, staple it into, an existing, the existing platform. So doing that for 8 years, it became this big, kind of rubber band ball of code that didn't connect in a lot of ways, and it was starting to break at the seams, and we were losing customers. It was becoming very difficult to manage. We might have had 60 bands on it at the time. And it was just becoming very difficult to get updates to people to service and support all the tours. So at that point, I was kind of wrestling with, well, I know this can be a business. I don't know how big of a business yet, but it's proven that this need is out there and that we've kind of solved the problem. I realized that I couldn't do this on my own. We weren't making enough money to do anything more than, barely support the existing infrastructure we had. And then I, in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh yeah, I probably got to start making a living at some point. It'd be nice to do that in the next 10 years. So, kind of on my own, went out and formed a seed round with the goal of raising $500,000. That took, a good year. And it's, you talk about the friends and family round. I was a little hesitant to go to friends and family directly, just because even though I really believed in the product, there was really no comparables, to prove that this could be a business. So I was really, to, go very internally, to raise this money. Got a lot of advice from friends and family, so I kind of refer to it as a friends of friends or family of family type of round, even though there were family and friends that pitched in, that were critical to the seed. So that took, the better part of a year to do. And then I think, as every, smart investor says, always raise more, twice as much more or 10 times more than you think you need. Which back then I thought, wow, if I could get 500,000, this is going to last me for, 20 years. I could really milk this out. And, 3 months into that, when you really start building an infrastructure and hiring real developers, and having really really fixed costs to a business, I realized, okay, we're projected not to be profitable for quite some time. I'm going to need to raise some more money. Through a series of great connections, I brought in a CEO that had a lot of experience in the software industry and helped me kind of convert that seed round to a Series A, which was a $2.2 million Series A round. So this all blends between 2008 and really until 2012, 13. Think 2008, kind of inexperienced guy raising money in a questionable market right after the market crash was not the easiest, time frame to go out and be collecting checks. And the interesting thing was, because we were software and we had such a kind of sexy market, and we had, Dave Matthews as an investor, and we had Neil Young as a client, and Metallica, and Black Eyed Peas, and all these great names. I think looking back, that opened up a lot of doors, to big VCs, institutional investors, angel groups, which was exciting. We'd always get kind of that first and second meeting with anybody, that we wanted to. Most of them, I think, were, sincere in their interest. I think if we were doing software in a completely other market and it wasn't as interesting, we probably wouldn't have gotten those meetings. So, the meetings did two things. It was great because we got a lot of great advice from really smart people, and it was, frustrating advice, and it was hard to hear at times about how our pricing model isn't going to work, or how our, go-to-market strategy was half-baked, or, just things that, were very basic that, I hadn't thought of. And also coming from my industry, it was also frustrating to try to explain, to VCs in particular that are used to building 500, billion-dollar businesses, that this is not going to be that large of a company. It's not going to be that big of a market, but it still could be an incredibly profitable business because we're first to market. We've got a great track record, and we're known in the industry, and we have a great product, et cetera, et cetera. So really those years at the beginning were really challenging because I needed the funding to maintain the infrastructure. At this time we were completely redeveloping the platform for our products. We had staffed up to about 10, 12 people, to start with the sales support and, especially the development of it. So it took a couple years to redevelop the software. It took another couple years to kind of introduce it back into the market and convert, our existing customer
Right.
base into, a lot of these customers on the original product. We had taken 10 years to get them comfortable in our first phase of the product, our first
Right.
version. And then, it's like the day they are comfortable with it, we're like, oh, sorry, here's a brand new, you're no longer using, Windows, you're using Apple. It was kind of, like that kind of
Right, because
changed to a lot of people.
it's a change. They were comfortable, they'd gotten used to it, and now
Right.
you're saying you need to learn something else, but it's going to have more features and more benefits.
Exactly, because the really, and probably 90% of these people are still customers today, but they had become so comfortable with all of the intricacies and the flaws in our first version that they didn't see the flaws anymore. And
Right.
they were, when you hit this button, they were used to it crashing, so they just knew not to hit that button. And it was
Kind
those
of
kind
like
of things.
Microsoft.
Yeah, great analogy. I wish.
We're used to our computers freezing up. We just know we have to live with
Right,
that.
right.
Right.
And so, at the first version of our software, we had built a great, loyal set of a very few customers, that had become very dependent on it. But, for every 30 people that would try, to demo the software, it wasn't intuitive. The user interface was kind of all over the place. So, during when we re-architected the whole thing, we had to step back and say, okay, this has to work for everybody because it can't just be a piece of software that works for the stadium level, arena level Metallica, Dave Matthews bands. This has to work for the bar band, the theater band. It has to work for everybody. So we had to really, put a lot of thought into the architecture and the user interface. So it made sense if you had a, stadium tour, it made sense, or if you had a bar tour, it made sense.
Well, and that raises an interesting question. Your customer base isn't a specific niche, but it's size-wise, it can be the really small micro band or business to the really big corporation successful bands. So, how does the pricing work for features? Is it one price for all? Is it a number of users? How did you finally answer that question? How much is it?
Yeah, so the other big shift we did originally was a license model. You just paid for the license of the product, and it was yours, for life,
Right.
which was great because at the beginning we'd get these sizable chunks up front, and yay, we can eat and we
Right.
can pay for lights. But 8 months later, when you're still supporting that person and the money's been long spent, it became a burden. To do that. So we switched to a monthly subscription model and released kind of the second version of Master Tour. And it scales pretty well because, the small theater bar band only needs one license or two
Right.
licenses. And then when you get up to the Rihannas or to the big management companies, or booking agencies that use it, or some of the larger touring organizations, they need a lot more licenses. So it scales. It's kind of a Salesforce model where, if you're a small operation, you just need it for one guy. But if you're a bigger, operation, you
Right.
need it for dozens of people. So it, we fixed on that pricing model and it still works, pretty well today.
Well, and you're continuing to evolve the product, right? You're
Yes.
adding additional products. Master Tour isn't the only product for Eventric, correct?
Right. That was the core product. And then, even in my original business plan, we always predicted that we could be a pretty influential, service provider in the entertainment industry, just because, seeing, back then and even now, it's a fairly antiquated or it's a fairly fragmented industry. A lot of moving parts, a lot of people connected, to an event, whether it's a booking agency, publicist, travel agency, promoter. the venue itself, staging, lighting, audio companies, the band, you know, tour management. I mean, there's dozens of different entities that are connected to one event, even on a smaller level. So, you know, we realized, you know, back at the beginning that, you know, this fragmented industry could use some type of standardization to this. And, you know, because we weren't a massive company with a lot of resources, we focused on the touring element of it, on Master Tour. You know, kind of right at the beginning when we were raising money, one of our really good clients that was working with Alicia Keys and Jonas Brothers came to us with a kind of a unique, you know, problem of managing their guest list requests. In the industry, especially at the higher level, if you're a big band like a Rihanna, like a, you know, Britney Spears or Bon Jovi, and you go to each market, every city that you play in, you have a series of tickets that are held for the band just for the guest list.
Right.
You know, the band needs to take care of, you know, the moms and the dads and the friends and the labels and the management companies. And there's just kind of a certain industry expectation that, you know, there are going to be a various level of comps, you know, complimentary tickets
right.
at the show. And it's a very small amount. But I think as that expectation in the industry grew, more and more people, you know, were, and especially when you get a massive show like the Jonas Brothers or Miley Cyrus or Bon Jovi, when, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people that kind of have this expectation that they can get tickets internally.
Right.
You know, well, the band was losing a lot of money. You know, sure, you know, there's certain people that I think are fair to comp, you know, lifelong supporters of the band. You know, you might
mom
not want
to. Mom and dad.
Yeah, you might not want to send mom to Ticketmaster to buy
right.
a, you know, ticket. But at the same time, you're talking of hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars over the course of a tour. and as touring has become more and more significant to, you know, kind of the bottom line of profit for tours, you know, they've really looked at every angle and every aspect of the revenue. And so back then, you know, the guys that we're working with are like, hey, you know, we're giving away $1 million a year in ticketing to people that really shouldn't get comp tickets. We just don't have a mechanism to charge them. We you know, this has nothing to do with secondary market, which is StubHub, which is, you know, kind of pay at the high, you know, pay
right.
whatever, you know, the highest amount would be. Basically, the concept is there are a lot of people that we would like to take care of that, you know, are vendors, supporters of the band. We don't want to charge them StubHub levels.
Right.
We want to charge them the face value of the ticket, but be assured that they can get tickets, but, you know, we don't feel it's fair to comp them.
So it's more
tickets.
Of a set aside than a complimentary.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. it's a small portion of tickets, but we developed what is our, you know, another one of our products called Live Access. And you can think of it as just a ticketing company. I think it's just as good as many ticketing services out there in a lot of ways. It's very unique in the way that it's very controlled and it's invite only. You know, so it's kind of like an evite for ticketing where you have to be invited into the system, and the administrator of these tickets can very exactly control who gets to see these tickets and how many they can buy, you know, and at what price, you know. So we built a system that's very flexible in that way, because, you know, there's scenarios where, you know, we worked with some bands in the past, like Pearl Jam and Depeche Mode, where, you know, they didn't want to charge these people tickets, but they thought it'd be fair if, hey, you want tickets to Depeche Mode, you make a charitable donation through Live Access.
Okay.
You know, so great.
Right.
You get, you know, Depeche Mode tickets. And again, these are still internal tickets. They're not
right.
open, you know, and they're not scalpable because it's a guest list name. You can't resell these tickets because you have to show up, you know, the name that purchased the tickets has to show up at the will call, show your ID and get the ticket. So it's very
okay.
secure in that way. But, you know, some of the tours we work with, like Depeche Mode, we're like, yeah, we don't want to charge, you know, Aunt Bessie $120 to go to our show, but we think if she just, you know, put $20 donation towards our charity, you know, then everybody wins. You know, we can
right.
we can get the tickets, and we don't lose, you know, we don't lose a ton of money, and we can, you know, the money that we would have charged, we get to put towards charity. So there's a lot of flexibility in that way in the Live Access platform. But again, that was kind of a need that we realized, you know, being associated with, you know, the operations of the touring industry. You know, it was great that they came to us. You know, they were very confident in our skills and kind of, you know, being able to architect a system like this. And that's where I still think a lot of the opportunity is in for our business, you know, of kind of expanding, and making this fragmented industry a lot more connected.
So essentially your customer base, the people you're interacting with, helped in the product development and saying, this
oh,
is
yeah.
the next product we need, and we believe in you, and so we're coming to you saying, help us.
Yeah, in two ways. You know, at a very high level where someone's like, you know, great, Master Tour is awesome, cool, but, you know, we need something to manage our ticketing. And that's, you know, at the beginning, you know, we would have entertained probably any suggestion at any product, you know, just because, you know, we thought it would help grow the business. You know, now, you know, because of very controlled resources, even though we have a lot of these opportunities, you know, to develop these other services, you know, the focus now is to continue building on Master Tour to keep that kind of the industry leader in this type of product. And it's always evolving from customer, you know, adaptation and suggestions, you know, where you know, 98% of our product has been built from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of users saying it would be better if it did this, or why doesn't it do that, or I don't even need this, why is it there? So, you know, for almost 20 years now, it's evolved, you know, through that type of customer feedback. And then, you know, that's kind of the low-hanging fruit. The big, you know, other services that we can develop for the rest of the industry that are still big opportunities, you know, are kind of the next challenge. You know, developing other services that are, you know, in a lot of ways still connected to our core product.
That you're aligning your skill set with the opportunities and being able to allocate your resources, your limited resources, which everyone has limited resources,
right,
to be the most effective option for growing your business and not diluting your brand.
Right. Yeah, we want to make sure that no matter what direction we have moving forward, that we never take, you know, kind of the focus off of our core product. You know, so we've never really, you know, there was a moment in time when we were desperate for money. We had an opportunity to pivot, you know, somewhat and build a product that really had nothing to do, you know, basically the services we provide are all kind of backstage, you know,
right,
is nothing to do with the fan. The ticketing really even doesn't have anything to do with the fan, because a lot of people that buy those tickets aren't fans. They just want to go to the show because they know somebody in the band.
Right.
You know, so we've stayed very away from the opportunities of partnering with other ticketing companies, with fan club companies, with, you know, there's 100 businesses out there of like how to build your fan base. And, you know, over the years, we could have easily partnered with some of these companies or even pivoted into that direction. You know, but fortunately, we've stayed in a very, in a smaller market, you know, but now we're kind of the industry leaders in this service provide. You know, it's more of a B2B business we're in, not a B2C, you know, which is 99% of the other kind of music industry businesses that are out there.
Well, and how did you resist that temptation to lose the focus from your B2B type focus into that temptation? You need money, and here it is sitting here. You could do this, but how did you arrive at the conclusion that, no, we're staying with our core and what we've been doing?
Yeah, I'd love to take credit for saying no. I was always, you know, focused on the core, you know, never diverted, you know,
you were
from
never
the path.
Tempted.
I was never tempted. There, you know, the brutal reality is there was never any partner or service or entity that came in and said, here's $10 million. We want you guys to utilize your skill set and go this direction. You know, and I think, you know, in all honesty, you know, through the desperate years where, you know, we were bleeding money and there was really no hope in additional funding in our growth rate, you know, even though traditionally it's been, you know, 20-30% a year, you know, there was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, I still knew there was still a couple more years before we'd be profitable. So had someone come in and said, hey, we love what you do, but we want you to, you know, put that on the back burner.
Come to the
and
dark
go
side.
In this come to this dark side. You know, I would have done everything possible. And there was an opportunity that got close, you know, and kind of in the terms of that, you know, I made sure that we weren't, you know, that we weren't leaving our customer base. I mean, the future of Master Tour and the product might have been, you know, hampered a little bit if we had taken this direction, but at least I knew for the foreseeable future, the core product would still be a service and we wouldn't leave our customers high and dry. You know, so it was always kind of that balance of, you know, is this the right direction, even though the customer base is loving this and it's continuing to grow? But if this opportunity came over here, we could do both, kind of leverage our positioning in the industry, to build these other exciting products without, losing the core product. That would have been the ideal situation. Now years later, fortunately, we didn't take any of that direction, and we avoided some pretty disastrous partnerships, that could have happened out of desperation, literally of sitting there and pondering, well, if we don't take this deal, if we don't take this loan, or if we don't do this partnership, we won't survive another month. And it fortunately we didn't take, most of these bad deals, and we got through it. But those are probably the most trying times, in building the business, when, you're sitting there with this decision, and it's kind of do or die. Well, if I take this, if I take this deal, or if I move in this direction, it's questionable for the future, of our original direction, of our business. But if I don't take it, we're done anyway. So it was kind of that fear. And looking back, probably every day I look back at some of these deals that fortunately we didn't take, that would have gotten us through that next little hump, but probably would have folded the company by now, because they would have made us completely shift direction or dissolve the company or who knows what.
Right. So slow and steady won the race.
Slow and steady won the race, right? Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit more about your customers and how new customers find you. Is it referral? Is it, how are you making those connections to get new customers in using your products?
Super Bowl ads. We've been running Super Bowl ads every year for 10 years. No, kidding. Yeah, it's been almost 100% work.
Don't you wish?
And I wish I could afford a Super Bowl ad, and I
But
would
you wouldn't do
really.
it if you
Oh,
could.
God, no. No. I mean, I don't know if I would do it if I was. Well, who knows? I don't know anything about that world and the effectiveness of
But you might put a little logo on Brianna's shirt or something, right? So that this event by
Yeah,
Eventric.
right. It's, our customer base is a very, and this was one of the more challenging things to try to explain to, investors, how we attract our customers. And when you tell an investor or anyone looking at your business model and saying, yeah, we're going to build this on word of mouth, everyone kind of laughs you out of the room. Yes, saying, saying that's a great thing to have, but you need, kind of go-to-market strategies to support that. And we've always, again, mostly because of limited resources, we've never hired a marketing department. And our industry is, and the other thing that I find myself saying a lot is, no, you don't understand my industry. And I've even brought people in to my business that originally I've said, you don't understand my business, my industry. And they've said, no, every industry is the same in a lot of capacities. And then a year into my business, they're like, you're right. I could never have predicted your industry was like this because of the fragmentation and just, there are things so different about the music business, even on the operational side, that I haven't found any comparables to anything outside
It's
to this day.
fragmented. It's fragmented, but those fragments are connected by the communication between the groups and the bands and when they come together and those kind of
Right.
things, right?
Yeah, in a way, but it's amazing the infrastructure of some of these companies that, or the lack of infrastructure. We've got some incredibly brilliant people that are leading our industry, and there are some incredibly brilliant people that are just managing the careers of, smaller bands as well. But you look at some of the biggest tours or management companies, $100 million plus businesses, and many times they're not run by, MBA, Harvard rock stars. They're
Right.
run by guys that were, the van driver, of their buddy, 25 years ago, or a bartender that, looked across and saw this awesome band on stage and begged them, to let him manage, their career. And then they turn out to be leading, be one of the icons of our industry. So it's, it's not typical when I think in the outside of this industry, $100 million business is,
Still
run
run on
by.
QuickBooks by the
Yeah,
neighbor.
exactly. I mean, a lot of these massive businesses, don't have, I mean, they have very smart people, lawyers, business managers, of course, managing everything, but, they don't have like a Salesforce, enterprise solution in place. They don't have
Right.
anything, any kind of systems in place, because a lot of times these massive businesses are still, 5, 10, 20 person shops. They're very small,
Right.
because their world, you know, the management company, quote, is, you know, a small shop. Now they're managing 20 bands or 50 bands, you know, so in theory, they've got, you know, 600 employees. But the employees in our business are more like subcontract workers. You know, okay. They only are employed during the course of a tour. So it's different in that. And that leads to a lot of payroll challenges, and it leads to a lot of, you know, human resource challenges and, you know, things that just apply to almost any other industry and not this one.
So it's very ad hoc systems and processes. Well, if it worked 20 years ago and it's still working today, why would we change it type thing?
Right. I mean, there are multi, you know, $1 million businesses, huge businesses that are still run on some FileMaker database that like an intern made, you know, 15 years ago.
Right.
So it's, and it works, you know, but, you know, Aventric wants to step in and kind of say, hey, you guys, you know, we want to be the service company. We want to come in and say, this is what we do. We're good at it. We've got experience and traction. We want to develop these systems from you. You're not a software company. You know, don't try to build it on your own. Let us do the work. You know, pay us a nominal fee, and we'll provide these services to you with updates and security and patches and everything that you'd expect in a normal, you know, enterprise solution.
So, what's on the table for 2016 and beyond for Aventric?
So, we've kind of, I would say, cornered, but you know, we're definitely the industry leader in tour management software. You know, and that basically means that we've, you know, I think can be credited to creating this niche market with a product. And we've got, you know, we have thousands of users on the system. We've had, you know, we have about 80,000 total users kind of in our network. And that all right now is relational to managing the tour. You know, so the tour gets booked and then boom, there's a lot of people involved in that tour, big or small, that are part of, you know, executing, you know, and archiving and operating that tour. That's kind of where our software is now. The big opportunity, you know, that we want to get in this year is, you know, stepping, organically we've grown outside of the touring world just by association of being with people using our product that have stepped out of touring with a band and started touring with, you know, like experiment or, you know, products or corporate events. You know, we have a lot of kind of non-band type of events using our software now. Probably 20% of our business ranges from, you know, circuses and churches and things like motocross and icecapades and even political campaigns and book tours. And there's some actors that use our software to manage their, you know, movement and schedules and credential management. So we're trying
expanding into different user niches.
Yeah. I mean, you know, our software can be applied for anything that moves people around, you know, kind of that rotate around an event. You know, it's not going to work for Southwest Airlines, but it works for any group that travels around with a group of people that sets up an event, breaks down an event, and organizes an event. So kind of the big step for this year is to identify more of those users. And kind of that potential market, which is, you know, I think 50 times bigger than the music business. And the other thing is continually, you know, improving our product. And there's all, you know, we have a list of about 600 features in our development queue that have come from customer suggestions. You know, some of the features will take 10 minutes to do. Some of them will take 6 months, you know, so we kind of rate these and sort them accordingly. So there's always kind of that, you know, continuation of product, you know, evolution kind of in our pipeline. But then the other big thing is, you know, we're starting to make various strategic partnerships with some services that can really benefit our users. So this year we did a partnership with a telemedicine service, Wellvia Solutions, which is great. So what that means, and we've had clients like Maroon 5 and Daughtry and a bunch of others adopt this service. So through our software now, if you're on the road, even if you're at home and Maroon 5 travels with, let's say, 60 people, so band, crew members, anybody associated with the band, and if they start feeling sick on the road, again, if they start feeling flu-like symptoms or they've got a sore throat, they can pick up the phone, dial a direct number through our software, get connected to a board-certified physician in that state, you know, licensed to practice in that state, and 90% of all of these ailments and all these conditions can be diagnosed over the phone. Which sounded suspicious to me at first, but I've spent a lot of time with this group and seen it in action. And it's true. You think how many times you go to, you know, a clinic or the doc, and they're like, okay, you need a Z-Pack or you need this. I
Right.
mean, 90% of the time, it's not
And you sit
critical.
there 3 hours getting exposed to the
Yeah,
flu
right.
and everything else and come out
And
sicker than whenever you went in. Right.
right. And so think about being on the road, where you're working 6 days, 20 hours a day for 6 days in a row, and you're in a different town. Even getting to a Minute Clinic, if it's anywhere near the venue, is a challenge because you have to step away
Right.
from, your duty, which, in this business, if someone steps away from their position at that day, well, there's a chance that, the show won't be able to go on. I mean, some of these
Right.
things are pretty, it's not like, okay, I'll just turn in that proposal tomorrow. It's, you've got, 6,000 people showing up at 5 o'clock, and if everyone doesn't do everything they're supposed to be, that's going to jeopardize, the entire event. So that notion and that, that's always overriding, I think, the people on the road. And what that results in is, okay, I'm feeling sick. I don't have anywhere close to an opportunity to do anything about it. So I'm just going to, hold it in and hope I get better and drink a lot of water and take some vitamins. And inevitably that leads to them getting more sick. And these guys travel around in basically a gigantic pillbox, a tour bus, sometimes 14 people within a
Incubator.
bus. It is. It's an incubator. You don't open the windows, so one or two guys get sick in there, and they're, you could not live with another person closer than people do on the road. So it gets everybody sick. So, we've seen this Wellvia Solutions be a great resource to be more proactive in your health care. So now if I even have the inkling of getting sick, I can pick up the phone and be like, hey doc, whatever, got this.
Right.
And the doctor could say, well, it's to be safe, I'm going to write you a prescription. There's a Walgreens 3 blocks away, send a runner, pick it up. So it's not health insurance, but it's just proactive kind of, health maintenance. So we've formed a great partnership with Wellvia. We and because we're bringing, because we have 80,000 people in our network, we get great rates. So we're able to go to a company like this and really get them to provide a great rate for our customers. And so it gives them an incredible discount on this service, and hopefully makes them kind of tour a little more healthy on the road. So we're starting to do a little more stuff in partnerships that can just benefit our users.
So, are you approaching these strategic partnerships or are they coming to you? Or
No,
both?
we no, I'd say the majority are coming to us, which is not, it's a nice position to be in. And another thing that I've really learned to do over the years is, be able to vet these opportunities before spending a lot of time with them. So, in the early days, and I think, anybody that's very enthusiastic about their business growth, takes on any call, takes on any meeting, even
Right.
travels for a meeting like this. And I think we're now in a better position where I think the more quality opportunities are coming to us. And I've got the experience to kind of see, what they look like and if they really benefit us, in the short, in the long run. And again, over the years, it was more about a short-term benefit. It was like, how is this partnership going to bring in money immediately so we can
Right.
survive? Now that we're profitable, we can look at more of a long-tail approach to these services and be like, this is a great idea. This is great for our growth of the business. It's great for our customers. And, we have the resources to kind of cultivate this over the next year or 2 years before we can really see any significant returns, on it. Again, these aren't huge steps.
Right.
These aren't huge pivots or anything. But
Slow
it's
and
nice to be in a
steady.
position. Yeah, it's nice to be in a position where we don't, have to rush anything for sake of keeping the business afloat.
So when you look at these kind of opportunities and when you're vetting customers, strategic partners, which way you're going to take Master Tour or if you're going to add other products, what would you say is the core criteria? How do you make that decision? Is it you alone? Is it your team? What is that process for Eventric?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's mostly me. I've got a great set of advisors that I can run things past, but really the criteria is 3-step. And I think depending on the opportunity, there isn't really any particular order to these.
Okay.
But it's what is this going to do for the growth of the business? And is this of value to my customer? Is this something that is going to A, benefit them and not confuse kind of the core message of what we're doing? And then the third is just kind of the quality of that partnership. The partnership that's approaching us or that we're going after, are they credible? Do they have the experience, that can see this through? Because I think it has to be a mutually beneficial partnership. I think both sides have to win on this for it to be, successful over time. So it's kind of looking at all those things. And we're still not in a position to really spend a ton of resources into developing these things. So it's, also a really strategic decision on making sure that if we do adopt this partnership or if we do go forward, that it doesn't derail the direction or it doesn't delay derail the resources that we have devoted to, keeping our current product running and updated and, interesting to our customer base.
So, in the time horizon going forward, the next couple of years, do you foresee having to go through another funding round to take advantage of all the opportunities?
Yeah, I sure hope not. It was such a I mean, I spent, including the amount of, mental anguish and stress, and then just the time I spent and my partner spent running, literally crisscrossing the country and, and buying last minute plane tickets because this guy in, Palo Alto really wants to talk to us.
Right.
I probably spent 80% of my time in those years worrying, structuring, pitching, and doing the roadshow of just investment,
Right.
and again, it was a necessary evil. I had to do that. I don't think we would have gotten any. We ended up raising about $1.5 million total, and without all of that work and without being rejected, 99 times for that one check, I don't think we would have gotten the money. And we certainly needed every cent that we raised to build the business. So I would really not, and everyone has always said to me, well, as soon as you don't need the money, that's when everyone's going to start throwing it at you. And it's
Right.
not that we would love to have a chunk of money so we can be more aggressive and kind of moving into, these other opportunities, without derailing our core business.
Right.
But I don't want to dilute the business anymore. And I certainly don't want to take my focus off of just business development, to, go through another round. And I want to, I don't, and I would don't want to do any type of down round for my existing investors. So if someone came to me and said, hey, we're going to give you $10 million for, 1% of your company, sign here, that, yeah, I'll probably take it.
So
But
send them to my house too after they borrow
yeah, right.
yours.
Gotcha. Make sure they have some left over. But
So,
I know that's not the case. I know that, I think going into another round would take a lot of hard work. It would take a lot of validation on, I think we've proven that we can be at the level we're at.
you're doing the slow and steady, which is great. You're focusing on your core business.
Yep.
You've been through the pain of raising that first round and then going to the more, let's call it smart money rounds.
Yep.
What were the three biggest lessons you had going through this process that if someone could have told you at the beginning you needed to know, what would they be?
There's a lot of lessons I've learned. Looking back, it's obviously easy to say, well, I should have taken that advice or I could have done that better. The, probably one, if someone was, asking me for advice, based on the trajectory of my business, I would say, do everything possible to stay lean. And I think we were really good at that. Even when we had money from investment, we didn't go crazy on marketing. We didn't staff up more than we needed. We didn't buy a mass, we didn't lease a massive, office space.
You didn't go out and buy a huge mahogany conference table and,
Exactly. We
right.
splurged and got a ping pong table and maybe a couch or two. And I think we
Right.
spent a few $100 on a flat screen TV for presentations and lunchtime movies. But yeah, it was very, we didn't go crazy. We didn't have a launch party, and hire Jay-Z to
Right.
MC it. We didn't do anything like that. And so I think that's a very obvious bit of advice you can give people. I can't even begin to give advice, for businesses that are in that, venture capital funded mode and they have to raise $50 million and they have to be a $500 million company in a year and they have to spend. I couldn't even begin to give advice, on that level.
Right.
I think the other, going back, like I said, I was very fortunate in certain deals that, had the other party said, let's do it, we might have just out of desperation. And if we had taken that deal, the existence of the company as it is today would be questionable. So it's easy to look back and say, don't take dumb money, or not dumb money, don't take, bad money.
Right.
But then you're stuck with being in a position, you're 3 or 4 years into the business, you've got a lot of your own money, and you've got 15 years of sweat built into the business, so it's hard to say, step away, this is not going to work, and focus on something else. So I think there is
Right.
that reality that I was blind to over the years where everything was pointing to the business not succeeding. But I wouldn't give up, and it was a little bit of stubbornness, but it was mostly out of belief of what I knew the product could be and the reaction that we were getting from our customers. So the advice would be, yeah, don't do whatever you can. If the deal sounds bad, it probably is, no matter how bad you need the money. Keep things lean as much as you can.
Believe.
I
Right?
guess, yeah,
Believe.
and believe in it. And I think be honest with yourself. I was fortunate to, I didn't go, I wasn't sitting there one day and saying, I'm going to go find, a problem. I'm going to go identify a problem and then raise some money and build a business to fix that solution, which I think is, a lot of the core of,
Right.
I think when I read about successful startups, most of the time it's the person that was out there that was having this problem or being in the position, to realize this need and spent time and or years, developing the idea and the concept and having friends use it or trying it out on the side before, really going all in on the business. And again, I was very lucky just because of, the surroundings, of being in that environment that I could kind of test this idea for years and years and years before, going all in, and trying to build a business around it. So that's probably, I think, key in startup, is you
Slow
really,
and steady wins the race.
yeah, and you've just got to not just believe that a solution exists, and especially in this day and age, where there probably isn't a unique idea out there that someone hasn't already thought of, it seems. But, you could have said that 5 years ago, and then all of a sudden you have Uber, so I think there's
Right, or
always
Google or
opportunities,
whatever,
right?
right, yeah. But each of those companies are somebody seeing that experiencing a problem they have and going out, which is what you were talking about.
Right.
And we're going to wrap it up on that note.
All right.
And I want to thank you for your time this morning, Paul.
No, thank you.
And to our listeners, stay focused on the important things.